From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Jordan vows to eradicate Islamic State. We continue our conversation on Chad's role in the fight against Boko Haram.
First, Chad was called by Cameroon. Guys, we need your help.
Working for better breathing in China. And Hawaii, vulnerable to tsunamis, prepares for the worst. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yockey. Jordan says recent airstrikes against Islamic State targets are only the beginning of its retaliation for the gruesome murder of a Jordanian military pilot captured in Syria in December. Jordanian warplanes launched dozens of airstrikes against the Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq Thursday after King Abdullah vowed an earth-shaking response to the killing. Foreign Minister Nasser Judeh told CNN television late Thursday that Jordan will go after Islamic State militants, quote, wherever they are, with everything we have. We're going to go after them and we will eradicate them, said Judeh, who referred to Islamic State fighters as cowards. King Abdullah said Jordan will continue the fight to defend its people and religion. A slickly produced Islamic State video emerged this week showing the pilot locked in a cage, doused with gasoline, and burned alive. As we reported Thursday, Chad has taken the lead role in a multinational effort to help Nigeria retake areas seized by Boko Haram. The militant group is blamed for thousands of deaths in its fight for an envisioned Islamic State. Today, we continue our conversation with VOA French to Africa correspondent Idriss Fall. This seems to parallel, in my mind, the rise of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, in that it came from a grassroots sort of group in a poor area.
Mostly, it's where they put their seed, and it's in poor areas. And now, with internet and social media, and help them recruiting, and they had the same method. So, barbarian killing people for I don't know what. I have not seen, even in northern Syria, even in Afghanistan, even in Libya. I have, even in Yemen, I haven't seen an Islamic group building a school. That's the main answer. I think they do grief, they kill people, they burn people. Women are forced to wear a veil and even kind of put in slave because those guys, they marry four, five women. But I have not seen in the long run where it will go because... if you want to hold the state, you are maybe able to build roads to put kids at school. So despair for people going to bring more despair, I think.
Now, are there treaties that allow these countries near Nigeria to cross borders like the Chad forces seem to have crossed?
First, Chad was called by Cameroon. Guys, we need your help. In the beginning, Nigeria did not like that because Nigeria is holding election on February 14th. But the government of Nigeria know that the Chadian troops are very well organized. And they are the only army in the region which grew up fighting rebel groups in the whole region there. You have armies, but armies who never went to war. So they don't have the tradition of fighting. Chad has that tradition. And after the agreement, so they crossed, and now they are in Gamboru, they are in Nigeria, and the government of Nigeria was saying it is not against our law to have Chadian troops here. Same thing in Niger. So they have an army, and they allowed Chadian troops to come, and they are positioned right on the river. They have agreements, and they are planning to set up African Union troop of 7,000 soldiers, but they don't have the money yet. So waiting for that African Union the troops to come, I think somebody has to begin the job.
Well, thank you very much for your insight and your knowledge on the subject.
Thank you very much, Susan.
VOA French to Africa correspondent Idriss Fall here in our Washington studios. Egypt's criminal justice system has come in for sharp criticism after an Egyptian court handed down life sentences to 230 people accused of inciting violence and attacking security forces during demonstrations in 2011. Among those sentenced was prominent human rights activist Ahmed Duma. Robert Herman, vice president of the watchdog group Freedom House, issued a statement accusing Egypt's courts of becoming a tool of repression rather than a pillar of justice. Herman called on Egypt's leaders to focus on building a democratic system rather than on repression that fuels turmoil. Other institutions and states have heaped criticism on Egypt's human rights record. Keith Harper, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Council, recently said Egypt violates freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly, and association, and deprive thousands of Egyptians of fair trial guarantees. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy asked Maha Azam, head of the Egyptian Revolutionary Council, who are the members of the Egyptian Revolutionary Council and what are they trying to achieve?
The Egyptian Revolutionary Council is a broad platform of Egyptian groups and individuals that are abroad now, but many of them were forced to leave Egypt. They include currents from the Islamists, including currents from liberal forces, those that are to the left of the political spectrum, and independents. The members of this platform or coalition live in Canada, the United States, Europe, Australia, across the world. And essentially what binds them is a commitment to seeing a civilian state in Egypt, a democratic state. And they share a common goal of removing the military from power and supporting the resistance inside Egypt. We believe as the Egyptian Revolutionary Council that we are an echo for those inside Egypt. We are the voice, if you like, of the voiceless, that we can actually speak out in the outside world and expose what is happening when our brothers and sisters inside Egypt are resisting or unable to tell the world outside exactly what's happening.
You've been active in meeting officials in Congress, State Department, White House that approves U.S. aid to Egypt. Have you been able to convince them to exert some sort of pressure to restore democracy in Egypt?
We found the meetings extremely fruitful. They were frank. They were productive. And I think in terms of our reading of the Egyptian situation, we have a great deal in common. We realized that there is a shared understanding of the challenges that Egypt faces under such a regime. And we are hoping that we can continue this dialogue.
What are you trying to achieve by visiting the United States while the Egyptian government is continuing its strategic cooperation with the United States?
As a movement, a broad movement of Egyptians opposed to the military regime, we have to engage with governments and with civil society in order to put forward our point of view, the point of view of millions of Egyptians struggling inside Egypt today. Therefore, we need to lobby, we need to put forward a clear message that we are committed to democracy and to counter much of the false information that is being, and fabricated information that is being sent to Western governments through the military regime.
What's your roadmap to achieve such a goal when the military has control over power and use of power in Egypt?
The struggle is hard. It's a long and arduous struggle to get rid of any dictatorship. But in 2011, Egyptians took the first steps. We can't give up. So now, today, we are reviving that revolution and that commitment to democracy. The Egyptian military is engaged very closely with all the corrupt elements and all the institutions of the state. Egyptians know this, but there are also many honorable and honest people in these institutions, including the military institution. And as the Egyptian Revolutionary Council, we call on all the honorable men and women in Egypt and all its institutions and throughout its society to stand up against this military dictatorship through resistance and protests on a daily basis, and through a rejection through different types of civil disobedience that may come about against this regime. And we outside, as Egyptians throughout the world, will continue to expose this regime and to say the truth about the horrors of living under such a regime until such day as inside Egypt the resistance mounts so that there is no escape for the military responsible or those parts of the military officer corps that were responsible for crimes against the Egyptian people.
Maha Azam, head of the Egyptian Revolutionary Council. China's environment ministry says air quality in most of China's major cities, including Beijing, failed to meet minimal standards in 2014. The state-run Global Times says while the air quality in 74 cities improved slightly last year, only 8 reached the national standard of annual average pollution density, with 8 in northern China on the 10 most polluted list. Among the 10 most polluted, 7 are in the heavily industrialized Hebei province, with Baoduo on top. The others are Jiangyan in Shandong province, Shenzhou in Henan province, and Tianjin in Shanxi province. While Beijing escaped the top 10 list, the number of good days also dropped in the capital to 47%, or 172 days. The 10 cities with good quality air are clustered in southern and eastern China along the coast. In 2013, China introduced an action plan on prevention and control of air pollution. The plan aims at cutting the concentration levels of breathable suspending particles, including ozone and carbon monoxide, by 10% by 2017. Last November, during a visit to Beijing, Presidents Obama and Xi Jinping announced a bilateral climate change agreement in which China committed to peaking emissions by 2030. Dali Yang is a Chinese specialist at the University of Chicago. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, change in China will take time, as it did in the United States.
It takes a while between the time you recognize the environment is a serious issue to the time when you truly get clean air. In Los Angeles, for example, it took more than a decade after many, many measures. So China actually had the so-called air apocalypse in 2013. And, of course, in 2014, a relatively small number of cities met the national air standards. But it's still an improvement, in fact, over 2013. And, of course, we do see action happening across the country.
How stringent are those new standards?
Well, the standards actually are not as good as in the U.S., but they are significant. Most importantly, the new environment, the amended environmental protection law allows for much more significant fines. Local governments are really working very hard to discipline polluting factories. So in that sense, actually, there are a very serious effort by Chinese society and the state to deal with the environmental issues. But of course, again, it's going to take time, and especially in certain regions of China, for example, in the province of Hebei, which is a huge, huge steel-producing province, there are you just cannot simply shut down all those factories all at one time. So there are always those kind of compromises. But at the same time, for example, power plants are installing scrubbers, and steel plants are improving their technology. So there are things that are indeed happening, and of course some of the smaller cement and steel plants are being closed down. But again, this is a marathon, not a sprint in terms of dealing with the environment.
Is there a concern that tighter environmental standards will mean slower economic growth?
Yes, indeed. In fact, already we see local governments waiting to invite or allow certain factories that used to be welcomed, those that do pollute significantly. And they are really taking tough action also against some of the central government-owned enterprises that used to be pretty powerful, that actually to be able to do whatever they wanted. Now with the anti-corruption campaign, some of those firms are on the defensive. So as a result, the local governments where their subsidiaries are located are able to take them on and to demand better improvements in their environmental footprint.
What impact, Dali Yang, will this recent bilateral U.S.-China climate change agreement do for China's environment?
Well, it's part of a long process. It's a significant commitment on the part of China, but nonetheless, it's not going to happen right away because we are talking about China reaching its maximum carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. And so it's still some time to come. But for China, though, this does mean a significant national commitment. Hopefully, actually, it may even reach the target earlier than indicated. But for the moment, already actually is laying a groundwork for more vigorous action on the part of China at the next stage of the global climate talks.
Will this impact the average Chinese life? In other words, maybe traffic congestion is a problem as far as air pollution. Will people have to drive less in China?
Well, already quite a growing list of cities actually restrict or limit how many cars can be added in each city. And they are using lotteries and auctions to allocate license plates.
A new study by the environmental group Greenpeace and Peking University finds that air pollution killed more people in China than smoking. The study says smog-producing pollutants accounted for more than 250,000 premature deaths across 31 municipalities and provincial capitals in 2013. China's president says clean energy sources, such as wind and solar, will account for 20% of China's energy production by 2022. Currently, China relies on coal for 80% of its electricity. The reality of rising sea levels caused by climate change means many coastal communities and island nations are more vulnerable to tsunamis. The U.S. island state of Hawaii is in the forefront of preparations for a tidal wave. But the devastating 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan led Hawaii officials to reevaluate their plans. Mike O'Sullivan reports that scientists and emergency managers are now preparing for an extreme tsunami, the kind that comes once in 500 or 1,000 years.
The 9.0 magnitude earthquake and resulting tsunami claimed nearly 19,000 lives when it struck the Tohoku region of northeastern Japan 4 years ago. Scientists say that Hawaii may be just as vulnerable. University of Hawaii researcher Rhett Butler says a mysterious sinkhole on the island of Kauai shows signs that a massive tsunami swept through the islands 500 years ago.
It's geology. You're looking for evidence that the ocean came on shore, and whether that's a sand layer or a bunch of basalt cobbles, you're looking for that kind of evidence.
The evidence was uncovered by paleobiologist David Burney, who discovered old coral, shells, and ocean sediment in a cave atop a slope 100 meters from the ocean. Civil defense agencies keep the public prepared, frequently testing their tsunami warning system. Scientists say a major tsunami could happen again. They say a theoretical 9.3 magnitude earthquake in the Aleutian Islands in the northern Pacific could create a super tsunami. University of Hawaii researcher Kwok Fai Cheung devised a computer model to simulate the waves from a huge Aleutian earthquake.
I used that as input to my tsunami model and simulate the propagation of the tsunami all the way across the Pacific Ocean from the Aleutian Islands to Hawaii.
The computer model shows that tsunami waves could sweep inland far beyond current safety zones. The Hawaii Emergency Management Agency works with local governments to draw up disaster plans. Emergency planner Kevin Richards says the old strategy calls for evacuation of 85,000 people on the island of Oahu.
If this event took place, we'd have to move 340,000 to 350,000 people to safety, a much more daunting task. And safety is not in the same place anymore. It's much further away. It's further up the hill. It's further inland.
Some residents could drive to higher ground, but driving is impractical in some parts of the islands, so residents there could walk to safety or take shelter on the fourth floor of a reinforced concrete building. New plans are being devised with an extended evacuation zone for an extreme tsunami. The Japanese tragedy of 2011 is still fresh in the memory of Hawaii residents, and scientist Rhett Butler says they take the threat seriously.
It doesn't mean it's going to happen in our time. It doesn't mean it's going to happen this year or next year. But it's just the nature of the tectonic forces on our planet. They just keep marching along, and Once you relieve all these stresses with these truly great earthquakes, the water responds.
And water is part of life on these islands. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. We invite you to stop by our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 6, 1778, the United States and France signed a treaty of alliance, bringing France into the American Revolutionary War against Britain. The alliance produced a tremendous financial and psychological boost for the Americans and would later prove decisive in winning the war. In 1819, Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles declared the founding of Singapore. Originally a trading station at the tip of the Malay Peninsula, the city-state's free trade policy attracted merchants from all over the world. In 1840, the Treaty of Waitangi was signed with Maori chiefs establishing New Zealand as a British colony. On this day in 1911, the 40th President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, was born. Before being elected president in 1980, Mr. Reagan had served as governor of California. Before that, he had been a popular radio broadcaster and actor. In 1922, the Washington Naval Treaty was signed in Washington, D.C., limiting the naval armaments of the United States, Britain, Japan, France, and Italy. The treaty sought to moderate an arms race that began after World War I. On February 6, 1952, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor, Queen Elizabeth II, ascended to the British throne upon the death of her father, King George VI. In 1959, Jack Kilby of the Texas Instruments Company filed the first patent for an integrated circuit. Integrated circuits, also known as microchips, contain millions of electronic components but are only the size of a thumbnail. They are used in virtually all electronic equipment today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On February 3rd, ISIL released a video showing its execution of Royal Jordanian Air Force pilot Moaz Al-Qassasbeh by burning him alive in a cage. In the wake of his brutal murder, President Barack Obama said in a statement that Captain Al-Qassasbeh's dedication, courage, and service to his country and family represent universal human values that stand in opposition to the cowardice and depravity of ISIL, which has been so broadly rejected around the globe. In televised remarks, President Obama also said that this is one more example of the viciousness and barbarity of this organization. And he said, "I think it will redouble the vigilance and determination on the part of the global coalition to make sure that they are degraded and ultimately defeated." The execution of Captain Al-Qassasbeh is ISIL's third highly publicized murder of hostages since the start of 2015. In January, ISIL released videos of the beheadings of Japanese citizens Haruna Yukawa and Kenji Goto. Secretary of State John Kerry condemned the murders of the Japanese men, saying in a statement that their barbaric killing shows again ISIL's brutality and extremist agenda. The United States, he said, will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with Japan in confronting terrorism. In an interview with CNN's Fareed Zakaria, President Obama predicted that terrorist groups like ISIL will ultimately be defeated, not only because of the efforts of the global coalition that has rallied against it, but because they don't have a vision that appeals to ordinary people. It is, as it has been described in some cases, a death cult or an entirely backward-looking fantasy that can't function in the world. When you look at ISIL, it has no governing strategy. It can talk about setting up the new caliphate, but nobody is under any illusions that they can actually, in a sustained way, feed people or educate people or organize a society that would work. Mr. Obama emphasized that the conflict with ISIL is not a religious war, because the overwhelming majority of Muslims reject ISIL's interpretation of Islam. They don't even recognize it as being Islam, he said. For us to be successful in fighting this scourge, it's very important for us to align ourselves with the 99.9% of Muslims who are looking for the same thing we're looking for: order, peace, and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.